Osiris.
Hi, I'm Richard Z. Rastafarian from Fear of a Craft Beer Planet, a podcast that talks a lot about the parallels between the beer industry and the music business. But really, we talk about whatever we want. The show is made up of four of us. Me, Richard the Rastafarian, the radio guy, Jay Rose, Ryan Egan, and Rob Forzik. They're the beer guys. They're the ones that teach me about craft beer, and I'm the one that gets the show on the air. You can find us on all social media platforms at Fear of a Craft Beer Planet.
I'm Ben Sawyer, and this is The Road to Now. You may have seen the episode title for this one and thought, did they just interview Ben Sawyer? And the answer to that is complicated because, yes, we did just interview Ben Sawyer, but it's a different Ben Sawyer. It's Ben Sawyer from Digimill. He's a game creator. He creates serious games. These are basically games that you use to educate people. And I've always figured that it was pretty difficult to balance education with making interesting games. I only had skimmed the surface, and it turns out this is a really difficult task. But Ben Sawyer, the other Ben Sawyer, that is, he's done a great job of doing this throughout his career, and he's now applied his skills to creating a new history game called Revolutionary Choices. The game is not quite out yet. It should be out soon, but he did send me a demo game, and I got to play it. And it's pretty remarkable. It did exactly what it's supposed to do, and I won't spoil it, but you'll hear why the game itself did a really good job of kind of throwing me into the frustration of trying to fight the American Revolution when you don't have supplies or soldiers or status or anything like that. Overall, it was a great conversation, and hope you guys enjoy it a lot. It was fun for me. I said, I'm going to sit down and play this Revolutionary Choices game, this demo. And I was like, I'll play it for like, you know, 30 minutes to get ready. And I think I spent a couple hours playing it. I had to stop to do the interview. It's really fun. And I think that it's aimed at school kids. And I think it's going to be a great thing. So definitely look out for it. As he says in the episode, you can find out more at revchoicesgame.org. Anyway, it's been a good week. Friday night, I did a reading at our local bookstore called The Bookshop here in East Nashville. And the theme was America. It's the thing they do there called Adult Storytime. And Joelle Herr, who owns the shop, she invites three people to read for 15 minutes from one of their favorite books. And it was awesome. I read Sarah Vowell's Lafayette in the Somewhat United States. Shouldn't surprise anyone who listened to our interview with Julian Isher on the Lafayette and his trail. But it just really reminded me about how much I love my local bookstore. And you guys out there, keep supporting them. As you guys know, you've probably heard this a bunch of times, but I keep saying it because I love this company. Libro FM is one of our sponsors, and it's Libro.fm. You can get the audiobooks that you love, and a portion of everything you spend goes to your local bookshop. In particular, if you haven't listened to Sarah Vowell, good gracious. Her books are outstanding. She reads the books. She's the voice of Violet in The Incredibles. And then she has all these great comics and actors read the other voices, Patton Oswalt and John Slattery, and just outstanding folks. So just another plug. If you go to Libro.fm and you put in the promo code RTN, you'll get 3 months of subscription for just $15. That is three books. It can be as big as you want them to be, or as small as you want them to be. But in the summertime when you're out mowing the grass or going on these road trips, yeah, it's great. I've been burning through these things. It's such a wonderful service. And knowing that you can support your local bookstores, that's why we went to them and asked them to come be our sponsors. So go to Libro.fm and enter promo code RTN. Get a book by Sarah Vowell, but you can also get books by the other authors we've had on recently. Another one I'll recommend now is Daniel Immerwahr's How to Hide an Empire, which is mind-blowing. All great. So go check out Libro. Give them some support. Support your local bookstore. Support The Road to Now. And, of course, if you're not interested in that, we would just really appreciate it. If you know somebody who might like our podcast, just tell them. Just one person. If everybody who listens to The Road to Now tells one person and they download an episode, that's going to be thousands more episodes. And we really appreciate it. We do this because we love it. And we really appreciate those of you guys who stick with us. Shout out to our patrons on Patreon. We're up to 50 now, and that's incredible. And Bob and I are getting together soon. It's pretty exciting because we're going to get together in Nashville in a couple weeks for the National Conference of State Legislators. They're doing their legislative summit in Nashville, and Bob and I are doing a panel on storytelling, and I'm excited about it because we get to be like over 1,000 state legislators there. Me and the CEO, Tim Story, have been working together. We're actually going to be doing on that Tuesday night a trivia night for millennial legislators. So we're taking turns writing questions and doing rounds. I'm really excited about that. And so there's just a lot going on here. Thank you guys for sticking with us. We don't have anything planned for that legislative summit to record for The Road to Now. But from history, I will tell you that the best possible predictor of Bob and I coming up with tons of content comes after the phrase, let's not really schedule anything. We'll just see how it goes. We end up getting a bunch of episodes like a couple weeks ago when Bob was playing at Wolf Trap and was like, I'm going to interview Pete Sousa. I was like, okay, that sounds great. And apparently you guys liked that because that got a lot of downloads. Anyway, without further ado, here's our guest, Ben Sawyer from Digimil, explaining to Ben Sawyer from The Road to Now how exactly to make a game. We hope you enjoy it. Thanks. I've never said this before, but Ben Sawyer, welcome to The Road to Now.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
What I find to be so fascinating is that I feel like I've been your shadow for a long time. I remember when I was on Twitter, I first was on there. I barely ever used it. I would get tweets saying, Ben Sawyer, it's so good to finally see you here on Twitter. You know, what's going on? And I'd be like, what games are you working on? And I'd be like, wow. I mean, I was in grad school at the time and I felt like I was being shamed for playing video games instead of instead of doing my research. But it's gotten pretty intense. I once received a check intended for you in the mail.
Jeez, how did that happen?
You came to Michigan State to give a talk.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
It must have been in 2010 because 2011. All I know is that when I got back from I was living in Russia at the time. I went and collected my mail, and it was like, oh, here's one from Michigan State. And I was like, whoa, it was a good check.
It's probably like a reimbursement check for travel. But like, I'm like notoriously bad at submitting those at times because like, you know, like usually I'll just submit the flight and the hotel, or sometimes the hotel's taken care of at a conference, right? And I don't submit like, you know, what I ate the night before I arrived or something, because sometimes the amount of work it takes to do all that and follow up is just, so it's kind of weird. They must have, I wonder if I actually got it. I wonder if they actually sent it on back to me. I should probably look at like unclaimed funds in my state, see, but.
You should. Yeah, and I have to admit right now, there was a point where I delayed in getting back to you. And the reason was because in the Road to Now inbox, I just saw an email from Ben Sawyer and assumed it was one that I had CC'd, like I had sent and CC'd Road to Now on. So anyway, yep. We came into this episode through one of these Twitter exchanges, and you said you were working on this game. And I think it's remarkable. I've always said it, the other Ben Sawyer's a cooler Ben Sawyer because he works on games. And now you brought it into history. Let's talk about how you got involved in this, because you've been involved in what you call serious games for like 2 decades now, basically, right?
Yes. So somewhere around 2000, 1999, I got involved in this sort of nascent idea of using games for purposes beyond entertainment. Now, certainly, like, games have been done for educational games for a while. A lot of them were sort of considered, like, kind of, they were, like, elementary, like, literally aimed at elementary students. They were often very sort of rote, kind of using video games to dress up flashcard-style exercises. And as computers and games got more sophisticated, people started looking and saying, like, couldn't we do more with this? Sort of it was somewhat inevitable, right, that we would get to these things. But some interests found out about my interest in game development, different things that I was doing and experimenting with, and they asked me to jump on this and sort of produce a couple of games at the time. And, you know, what we found was that there were a lot of other people doing it. So we started various sort of kind of loose affiliation groups using, like, you know, online listservs and others to collaborate, pull people together who are interested in using games for larger, sort of more sophisticated purposes often education, but it got into other things like health. It got into other things like sort of rethinking how simulations work. And it became this kind of converged area between video games, education, healthcare, training, simulations, now virtual reality, even more so. But I mean, overall, what I spend my time doing and have for the last couple of decades is helping organizations figure out how to use all these tremendous design and technology opportunities that are being developed under the guise of entertainment games and pull them over to solve other problems than just what are you going to do when you want to be entertained.
Right. And what's fascinating to me is the way that, you know, I look around, you know, as people, I myself, other people spend so much time playing these mundane kind of useless games. There's something about working your brain, you know, kind of even when I listen to, when I want to relax, when I'm in the middle of working and I can't relax too long, I will sit down and play like FIFA on the Xbox with the volume off and listen to a book on tape for like 30 minutes. And it convinces me that I have relaxed and played a video game. But in fact, I've just read mostly been reading a book the whole time. In fact, the funny thing is, if you look at any of my game profile accounts, it looks like I'm really good because I play so much. But then when you see where I end up, like in the list of like the rankings, I'm always on the bottom. And it's like I'm maxed out level, but I'm terrible at the game. but it seems like people want these things that work their brain. People like the idea of accumulating points or accomplishing something through this. I mean, even I'll say my Fitbit, which my wife got me for Christmas. It's like I will get up and walk so that I can not have to sit down at dinner with my wife and tell her that I didn't hit my quota for the day. So how do you harness all of this and bring it into something as focused as specific healthcare issues or history?
Well, the way I've always looked at it is that just on entertainment alone, and because of what video games are, this sort of combination of software and art, all kinds of different domains that come together to create a good video game, whether it's big or small, it really is like one of the most creative endeavors going. I think that it's really hard for people to argue that it isn't. It may at times seem immature, but it's amazing some of the stuff that's been done over the last, you know, almost like 40 years of video games. And the fact of the matter is, it's a gigantic global industry of technology and creative that, you know, is in excess of $100 billion a year globally. And so you would sort of say, like, what else can it do? Like, what, you know, when you think about creating believable characters, whether it's movies or video games, they're both chasing that same problem. But video games are trying to chase it in a sense where the person's not just using a rote script, but is potentially believable based on your own actions as a player. That's tremendously difficult work. Photorealistic environments, but even, you know, is tremendously difficult work. And doing that in real time. Remember, most of the computer graphics that we see in movies are not real time, but in video games they are. And so you're just talking like an order of magnitude more complexity and amazing effort just on a technology side, like pure technology. But then on the design side, I've always described game designers as being really good at being a group that knows the answer to something, but won't give it to you with just one button press, right? Like, otherwise the game would be click here to win and you'd click it and go, I'm done. Like, that would be the most efficient thing, right? Like, software is supposed to be efficient, but games are actually supposed to be deficient. They're supposed to actually impede your progress, but impede it in a way that is completely engaging, that makes you want to complete it. And so it's this really interesting notion of interface and experience. And how do you do that? How do you create these puzzles? How do you create also like abstract simulations? So like a simulation, like the person who flies me to wherever I'm going next, I hope they're on the most realistic simulator ever invented, right? But games tend to not want to do that, right? Because honestly, playing really, really perfectly defined simulators, which is a genre of games and entertainment, people love them. But like for a lot of game players, they're just like, I just want to put the jet up in the air and fly around and do cartwheels and do all kinds of fun stuff and maybe pretend I'm a fighter or pilot or whatever it is. But I don't want to do all the pre-flight checklist. Like, whatever it does in that game, you do not want your real pilot doing, right? Mm-hmm. And it's because games tend to abstract things. And but what in doing that, what they're trying to do is impart upon you like the gist of the system or the framework that governs it. If it tends to be a fairly, let's call it somewhat realistic game, right? We're not talking necessarily Pac-Man, which is a great game, but that's not what we're talking about in this case. We're talking about like when you play a game like, you know, a restaurant game, like where you're the manager of the restaurant, right? You don't sit there and have to count up your receipts at the end of the night. You don't have to wash the bar down. You don't have to clean up the puke in the bathroom. You know,
that'd be the worst game ever.
Shit. It's more of a larger system of thinking about like, what's the interaction between a menu and its engagement with your customers, or what is a sale like, or what does it mean to have like decor that people want, like all these things that are still true, but they're kind of the interesting parts, the big pieces. And so we abstract the simulation so that it's accessible. So you think of many games as being accessible simulations, and that's really neat because we learn in that way. Like if I were to learn how to run a real restaurant, I would have to go to a much higher level of detail. But if you were talking about just a high school student, just trying to get a gist, like how does a restaurant work? What is a general profit and loss on food being made? Like these things can come forward. And so one of the things that game developers, I think, are really good at is looking at a system and sort of deciding what's a really interesting way to present this to people, and what's a level of depth, or what's a way to abstract something. So in the case of the game that we're bringing out next, this Revolutionary Choices, the goal was to sort of abstract the Revolutionary War into a system that would help you to understand maybe what was going on. And it wasn't done by like, you know, creating a 3D environment of all the different battles, right? Like, it's not that. It's meant to be an abstraction of the politics, of the sentiment, of the dilemmas that were faced by Americans at that time who were trying to figure out how to win their independence from England at the time. So the goal of any sort of good game that's about something that isn't necessarily its own sort of completely made up thing, which also can be great games, but in this case, that's not what we're doing, is to figure out like how to represent something in a way that people can kind of understand and start to link back to that real thing. So somebody playing this particular game will learn about the Revolutionary War, but the challenge for them, if they want to go further, is to take the framework that we present, that abstracted notion, and then link it much more directly to a level of detail that they may want to pursue on their own.
Yeah, and this is what I think is so great about it, because you know, you sent me a link to the demo version of the game. It's coming out soon. It is so good, and what I love about it is I sat down to play it. And at first, it's kind of like, okay, you kind of got to get the feel of the game. It takes a little bit to realize, but there are factors you have to consider. Like one is morale, one is like unity amongst the states. Another one is like regional approval. Sometimes you have to, you know, cut the national approval to get one region back on your side. And you're kind of dealing with certain factors. You know, you're dealing with the amount of money you have, the supplies you have, the troops you have, and what I loved about this game is that, like, I sat down and at first I was like, I'm going to evaluate this game as a historian. And then, like, 30 minutes in, I was just like, I don't have any troops, man. I can't get any troops. Like, how am I going to do this? I can't even get my guys to attack. I don't have any troops. Right. And I was like, what's wrong with this game? And I was like, it's doing it is the thing. It's doing exactly the problem that everybody has. That you couldn't get anybody to fight. It was, it had that moment where I was like, it's doing exactly, it's creating the type of stress that's real. And it makes you, I guess, you know, in to a small degree, like more sympathetic to the issues at hand that the revolutionary leaders were facing.
And that's great to hear, because that's exactly what the goals were for the project. When the Society of the Cincinnati, who is the sponsor and subject matter experts who brought it to us, this is the oldest patriotic organization in the United States, and they came and said, you know, we represent the descendants of the officer corps of Washington's army that won the independence, and one of the goals of our organization is to help people understand what we did, what happened at that time. And what's interesting is when you look at most of the ways the American Revolution is taught, the Revolutionary War is a small element of it. It sort of goes, I remember talking to a friend who's a game designer as well, who he and I talk quite a bit. And I said, hey, I got this project. I'm going to do this. I'm going to make a game about the Revolutionary War. And he goes, spoiler, we won. I was like, and that's kind of what happens in classes sometimes. It is, there's a lot of time spent on the run up. Like, why did this happen? How did we get to the point where we decided to declare independence and we started fighting before the declaration was even declared officially? How did we get to this point? So we have a lot of time on those types of things, the Stamp Act, the Boston Massacre, the Tea Party, the various factions that start to break apart. And then they go, look, there's a war. And like, you know, there's a little bit of talk, like the French come in and it's because of Saratoga. And then there's Yorktown. So like it goes like a typical unit for a class on this would be like a week and a half on the run up. Then like maybe a few days to a week on the actual war. And then a longer unit thereafter, right? Which is when we write the Constitution. And I don't mean to argue that there should be more or less of any one thing. Having spent some time in schools watching the game be used and just knowing what schools deal with, both as a parent and as a developer of educational games, you know, my hats are off to them. They're trying to do a lot of things in a short amount of time. But the great thing about the game is that we really focus on the war itself. And so to the extent someone is getting a very basic understanding of the war, with almost in some ways we're kind of tongue in cheek. There's spoiler, we won. Now let's talk about the Constitution. This game can come in and sort of say, well, we almost lost like multiple times. It wasn't easy. And the thing that is really neat about the game, and this is where a game I think diverges from a textbook in this situation, is what you talked about. It's the feeling. If a game does a good job, at times when you're winning or losing, or when you're pushing against those decisions in the systems, how many troops do I have? What's my morale? Like you're trying to affect these things with your decisions in the game. You start to feel the game push back at you. And so people talk about feel like that it wasn't something the game said to them. It's how they felt when they were playing it. And what you're talking about is really interesting, because when we tested the game with a couple of college students, not just we see this game as being for everybody else, though we certainly want to see that 8th, 9th, 10th, 7th grade level where kids get their first major unit or second major unit on the American Revolution. These college kids, PhD students, he was playing and we asked him afterwards, so what was going on? And he said, almost to a T what you said was, he said, like, I know what happened. Like, I study this. I'm studying to be able to teach this. I'm studying to be able to contribute to textbooks and, you know, get my PhD. He says, but all of a sudden, when the 19,000 troops from the British show up on the shores of New York, I panicked. I started realizing and looking around at what was available to me and the decisions I had made up until then. And I realized I hadn't done enough recruiting. And I was like, I might lose. My liberty was in the toilet. Like I might lose. And he's like, I forgot what was going on. And I started realizing that I was in a different situation than just like, oh, hey, what is this about? And like, what's the next piece of text that's going to tell me that happened? And they started worrying about whether they were winning or losing. It takes over. And to the credit of the whole team that's been working on this game for a while, both of these pieces of feedback are good, because this is exactly the kind of thing we want a game to do that you wouldn't get from, say, a really good documentary series or a great textbook or some movie or something. We really want to be distinct, and feel is a big part of what makes games distinct.
Yeah, because when you start off with Lexington Concord, and you're like, oh, like I'm not doing so bad. This game isn't that hard.
Right.
In a Bunker Hill, and you're like, yeah, this ain't so bad. Like, we lost, but we did some damage. And then you go to the next season. Like you said, it's like, you've still got a couple thousand troops and you're feeling pretty good. And then you're like, oh, there's not, like, I literally, and it, like, with the game, it makes you make the decision to run away. Like, it won't let you just ignore it. Like, you have to, like, retreat, and you lose morale for it, and you're forced into it. And you find yourself multiple times, at least I have, I'm only in 1778 now, but I've played through since 1775, which is a couple hours that I've played the game. because I play all the non-required parts as well. But right. It's like, I find myself having to like look at the screen and be like, if I do this, I will get hundreds more troops, but everything else will go down. And I go, but I've got to do that, because if I don't, I can't even move because my generals don't have enough men.
Right. And this is actually was the goal of the game that Jack Warren, the executive director of the society, wanted for the game, which was really to focus on dilemmas, right? When you take the notion, spoiler, we won, you forget the fact that there were a lot of things that might have said maybe this wasn't going to work out, or what kind of country was going to emerge from it. And so the idea in this game is that you're trying to win the Revolutionary War, which means that you need supplies, you need troops, and you need money. But you're also trying to win it while preserving these like emergent notions of liberty and unity. Because what happens if you do it by like seizing all the supplies from everybody, by not allowing merchants to trade freely with England still, even though they were the enemy? What if you do it with, you know, trampling on rights of religious minorities that didn't want to sign up for being in the army? Like what would have happened? And we sort of force you to think about those kinds of ideas. And it acts as a sort of break on any sort of just purely tactical decision. And by doing that, it allows us to explore overall a larger sort of notion of what a war game should be, right? Like, so war games we tend to see in computer war games, they're all tactics. It's like, move these troops, put them there, you know, find out how to put firepower where it's needed. Like, it's, you know, and these are fine. I've played so many of these games. In fact, one of the first war games I ever played was a game called Saratoga, which was an adaptation done by a small programmer for the Atari 800. That was an American Revolution spinoff influenced by a game Chris Crawford, a famous game designer, did called Eastern Front 1941, where he made a war game about what was happening in World War II. And that game taught me about Saratoga, that there were multiple armies and they were coming from multiple directions and you had to fight them off. But in this particular game, what I'm really sort of proud of is that the goal was always to create a war game. And we've had people, when we've shown it, they're like, wow, this game really makes you think about like, what was Congress thinking at the time? Do they want these things? What other policies enabled these things? So like one of the things you think about is, if you have supplies, you have troops and you have money, right? That's where most war games start. You have those things and now you got to go do the tactics. In this particular game, the idea is that you don't have those things until you make these decisions that are trade-offs that generate them. So yes, you could have more men if you make alliances with different Native American tribes, because then you don't have to push troops to the border to defend the border, but maybe that has some other ramification. And so you have to make those decisions in order to then muster the things you need to fight the British. So the British are coming at you no matter what in this game. They're coming, they're sending troops at your cities, they're setting up at the major battles of the American Revolution that you may have heard about, and your job is to meet them on the field. And you have to meet them whether they outnumber you or not, or morale will drop. So one of the most amazing things about the war when you study it is that we were at times outnumbered. We were at times running most of the time. I mean, Washington was really, really good at like saying, yeah, I'm going to show up, I'm going to wave the flag, I'm going to maybe do a couple of volleys, and then I'm going to turn around and I am going to run.
No, that's what people are blown away by when people are like, well, I always ask my students, like, why is George Washington one of the great Americans, you know? And all they really know about him is, well, the first thing is always like, he's on the $1 bill. And I'm like, that's not a thing. That doesn't make someone great. Well, he was the first president. Okay, I bet all of you can think of a president that you have really strong negative feelings about. So just being the president doesn't make someone great. So like they go through it. And then some of them will say, well, he was a really good general. And I'm like, yeah, he was. But do you know why? Because he was really good at running away. And that was Washington's tactic. Just don't get caught.
Right. It's interesting. When I started working on this project, what I knew about the Revolutionary War was probably more than I learned in school, but probably a lot less than I know now. And one of the things that we do when we get a project like this is we don't try to become the subject matter expert, but we don't just sit there and allow ourselves to just have someone else tell us everything. First off, they don't even have the time. But second, it's hard to have a conversation as a designer if you don't level your own knowledge up a little bit, right? So, I mean, I may not be level 10. I mean, I know I'm not, but I can't show up to a project like this at level one. So it's interesting what you learn. And one of the things that I tell everybody that I came away with was an immense understanding and appreciation for Washington amidst all these people, right? Like, because we just went through a period where Alexander Hamilton is like the greatest person alive, this amazing musical, amazing piece of work, just, you know, incredible, right? But what we don't understand is that for all of these very young people at times, I mean, were around Jefferson, Madison, you know, Adams and others, Washington's sort of like a senior among them. I mean, Ben Franklin's there too. He goes off to France. But Washington is this, he has this amazing emotional intelligence that just permeates what he does. And he was dealing with a lot. He, in fact, there were arguments that he wasn't a very good general, right? Like he had other generals around him who were trying to get him fired.
Yeah, the Conway Cabal. The Conway Cabal, yeah. after Saratoga.
Yeah, they were and he has this just incredible sense of timing and maturity. You know, he goes into Princeton because he knows he's like, we gotta do something or this is gonna fall apart. He shows up to New York because if you don't show up to New York, at least to try and fight, then you have no revolution. Like people are just, like part of the reason he runs a lot is because he shows up too, yeah. and realizes we've got to do things in order to do it. There's a point in the war where they offer very early on, they offer him the chance to sort of like mediate this out. Like but they don't address the letter properly as like an equal. Yeah. And so he rejects the letter. He's like, no. So he does all of these things. And I don't know every last piece of it perfectly. But the very notion. And so we try to make sure that this comes up a lot in the game, which is this notion that when you fight battles at this time, the way militaries fight is they line up large groups of soldiers. And they march them towards each other. And it's almost like a giant game of chicken. It's who's going to run from the battlefield first? Because they don't have they're not a lot of like really good sharpshooting guns or people. They can't fight at great distances. Sure, there are cannons, but like a lot of people die because of bayonets, which the British know how to use very effectively.
And we don't even know how to use those until Baron von Steuben shows up at Valley Forge. And it's like, I see them cooking food with it.
I've always imagined that if Washington and other generals from their time came forward in American history, they'd be like, you know, this isn't going to work out for you Americans. And we're like, why? It's like, because we know. Like, we were the other side of this equation. And you're going to get worn out if you don't think this through. And so what ends up happening in this case is we had to model that in the game. So at the same time, the budget for games like this is not like the budgets for games like Total War, this amazing 3D battle simulator that can be done. And so our designers at Playmatix, Nick and Patrick, I kept pushing them. We got to have some sort of battle system. It can't just be like flip a coin. And so they came up with this idea of like, what if you merged rocks, papers, scissors with a game of chicken? And so what ends up happening is you have to think about how many men you have, you have to read almost like a poker hand. Like, what does this battle look like? How many men do I have? How many men do they have? What kinds of breakdowns of the types of troops? What kind of general? Are they aggressive? Are they defensive?
Do you have a better position?
Yeah. And like, and how many turns, how many rounds is this battle going to go? And what you have to do is you have to guess, like, what should you do? So you could attack or you could defend, and there are different subsets of those moves, each with little small variances of what they do, depending on what the other person does. So, like, if you attack and they attack, it's a little bit of a shared bloodbath. If you attack and they defend, depending on how the circumstances are, you can get really hurt. So you have to think, like, it's almost like rocks, paper, scissors. I throw paper. I'm really hoping they throw rock. but if they throw scissors, now I'm in trouble. And it kind of works, because at the end of the day, what you have to do most of all is decide, when do you retreat? How long? The longer you can hold out, you might actually turn the battle. But if you're gonna turn the battle but come up, you know, with 1,000 casualties, now you're gonna have to wait several turns to replenish that army. So you have to thinking, like, what is the equilibrium here that I need to maintain? And it tends to work out nicely. And one of the great ways that we know is the Battle of Bunker Hill. Of course, historically, we kind of think of it as a loss. But in our game, a couple of things are true. One is, when the Americans show up and they hang out enough to to show that they're fighting, you do get positives, because the French are watching and they'll sort of say, hey, look at these Americans. They're showing up. They're fighting. They're not giving up. I mean, yeah, they're losing, but their heart and souls are in it. And every now and then they're winning one, right? Princeton, or you can actually win Bunker Hill. If you know what you're doing tactically in the game, you can get lucky and potentially win Bunker Hill. I think it happens like 1 out of 3 times, which feels kind of good for a game that's trying to not just recreate history, but create the circumstances and then let certain things kind of fall where they might have differently. And so in the end, your job is to keep the fight alive, because the longer you can keep the fight alive, you can find those moments where you can turn the tables. And that's exactly what Washington was good at. That's what the Americans were good at. And it's a main major reason the French joined in Saratoga. We turned the tide there. And then that's the major reason we eventually get lucky and capture corner Cornwallis at Yorktown. And again, you know, history spoiler, we win.
Yeah, I have to say that there's like sometimes in the game where it's like so frustrating, like when you have to manage the invasion of Quebec, I'm just like, don't do it. Don't do this. It's not going to work out. It like makes you make a decision. And I'm like, can we all just like have a meeting and be like, I don't think they're going to go with us, guys. It's just
right. It's so this is the problem with a history game, right? So when you write a history textbook, the goal is to be 1,000% accurate, right? This is what we tried. This is what happened. But when you do a game, the first thing somebody playing a history game, whether it's ours or something else, like the first thing a good game player is going to say is, can I win Bunker Hill? Because if I can't, then what's the game doing for me? Like, right. Where's my role? What's my job? My job is just to not lose then. Like, I can't change anything. I can just change. The only thing I could change is losing, right? And so anytime I win, winning is basically meeting history where it was. But what we wanted to have to make sure that you could exceed history at certain moments. So, for example, you can win Bunker Hill if you do the right things, if you get the right circumstances, some of it random. So you have to react to the chance, just like in poker. In the case of invading Canada, you can actually win that battle in Quebec, but you have to know exactly what you want to do. And it has to do with being very, very aggressive at spending money early to raise a bigger army than you normally would be inclined to do, in which case then you can capture it only to eventually lose it a little later when an even larger force comes. But you can make that decision. But that particular one, you have to play it a few times, and then you can kind of use your knowledge of how the game works to try and do it. But that's what makes replaying the game kind of interesting. But what is interesting is that there are still limits, right? When you're talking with historians who know the stories of the war, there are times they're like, okay, there's certain bridges that are too far. Like, you cannot win the initial battle for New York. It's just like the so-called Battle of Brooklyn. So you can't. Like, they just had so many more troops, right? But what you can do is sometimes you can hold out a little bit longer. You can score a few extra points, and you can get out with more of your men than, say, may have been in reality. But so it's a problem. And the game has presented many of those kinds of dilemmas. Where do you break with history but not break history?
Right, yeah. It's interesting, because one of the questions I had for you was, you know, you talk about the question of, like, giving people autonomy within things. And I think about the, like, different types of games. Like, if you think about, say, Halo, I guess is a basic one. Halo, you have no control over the story itself. you play through rounds and then you get to the next step in the story, and the story's told to you and the story's cool, but like you playing the game is something separate. Like you've got to play the game to get the goals to let the next scene play. I've never seen one, and you know, I don't play a ton of games, so maybe I'm wrong about this. I've never seen one that set out with the goal of telling a very correct version of history. Is that a budget thing, or do you think it's just really hard to mix those two things?
I mean, there are not a lot of games about history that are like this that tried. There are a few. We've researched them. They tend to use history as like a context for something else, right? Like, so you could think of Assassin's Creed,
right?
You could think of many movies that kind of play ahistorically with things. But in this game, the challenge was to show somewhat accurate history, but then allow you to do different things with it. So it tends to be more like in historical or history professor speak, I guess, it tends to be more counterfactual than ahistorical.
Right.
And it's always a challenge. Like, again, the problem with a game is you're allowing players to do things, to make their own decisions, and you're trying to give them as much freedom as possible. And that's not just a budget thing. That's a design goal. I mean, there's a lot of constraints. And so in this particular element, we tried to kind of find this balance between using very historical circumstances or specific events and trying to figure out how much leeway you could have in when that event appears, or what that event's really about, or what could be some of the alternative ways it could have been handled should the sort of winds of history have been slightly different, or just people's disposition that day. I mean, certain things are very much tentpole. We don't make a big change with them. Like, you don't fail voting for the Declaration of Independence. That like early builds, that could happen. I was like, what do we do? Like that doesn't work.
But we're like, game over.
Yeah, right. It just doesn't make sense, right? Like, so certain things you had to kind of have happen. And there are a couple that are really interesting. So one that's a very good example of what we can do is early in the game, this is not a spoiler, when you're trying to get the French on your side, we give you the choice to appoint an ambassador to France. And you could choose John Adams or Ben Franklin. Now, if anybody's seen the John Adams documentary, not documentary, but the film with Paul Giamatti on HBO, they're great. It's an amazing sort of series. But he really brings to life the fact that Adams was a firebrand, that he had no patience for anything. And so you can choose Adams over Franklin. You could say he's the lead, and you get more immediate return, which sounds good as a player. Like, I need stuff now. But it warns you. It says, if you do this, when the French or if the French join, it might be a little more tepid because, of course, he's over there stomping his feet, whereas Franklin plays the long game. And there's even a scene in the series on HBO where Franklin really tears Adams a new one because Adams' impatience is causing trouble. And you can choose Franklin. And if you choose Franklin, you get less up front, but more when the French join. And that was an easy one to do, is sort of say, like, look, historically, Franklin was the lead. Franklin was the brains of the outfit. Franklin made what happened. But you can go against that with what was a very potentially realistic decision, that Adams would have been the person who kind of pushed and made the larger decision. Now, a different one is this. We struggled initially with what to do with Benedict Arnold. And it's really funny when we've tested the game in schools with young kids. Benedict Arnold, depending on how most people understand the actual history, he's actually probably one of our best generals at the time. He is really a very fiery, motivating, smart general. And he's like one of the heroes of Saratoga. He's just very, very good. There's a reason the country's in shock when he defects, is because it wasn't just some no-name guy. It was somebody that they really had a lot of high opinion of. So what ends up happening, of course, is people see Benedict Arnold as a regular general. And the kids all freak out when he first comes and is awarded to you, meaning like, here, you now have control of him. And they're like, oh my God. Like, he's going to totally turn around in the next game turn and stab you in the back, right? They don't know what to do with him. But it takes multiple, he doesn't turn right away,
right?
Historically.
You need him but for here's a while. The fact.
We all know he's going to trade us out, right? Like, he's going to sell us out. So what do you do? Like, we don't have a game where you can just say, okay, I get rid of him, like, you know, and everybody's waiting for it to happen. And like, if you say like hunt down traitors, like, of course you're going to, you might do it because you're like, this is, I know what's going to happen. And then this will, you know, I'll stop this from happening. So what we had to do is figure out like, how could you allow the inevitability? We know what happened as students of history, casual students of history. So what we do is we say at some point, you could have a singular choice. You can invest more money in your spy network, or you can invest more money in taming inflation. You can't do both, right? There's limited bandwidth, even just mind share, right? Like, right. Forget if we had enough money. It's just like concentration on two of these huge, momentous problems that Congress and the Army faced. So at the time, you might choose to tame inflation because you need more funds. You need that money because of how you've played up till then. If not, you're like, oh, it should be pretty obvious, right? You double down on that spy network, better chance you're going to get Arnold. You know it's going to happen, but now you're somewhat helpless, right? You can't use your perfect understanding of history because your perfect understanding of history might say, go after Arnold. But then the other part of history is coming out. Well, then you're going to let inflation run amok, which it did realistically. So we're giving you the goal, like, which one of these things that you know happens do you want to dampen? Do you want to make the less historical outcome, right? Which is better for you, but which one? So like, one of the things that's interesting is from design is we know that like, if we give you a good choice and a bad choice, the player always takes the good choice, right? It's like Eddie Izzard does this bit where he says, you know, the church says cake or death. Right. And he says, oh, cake, please. Right. Like, who would ever choose death? But in this particular case, what we know is that when we're giving you these choices is when we give you two good choices, it's hard. Like, which good choice do I want, or two bad choices?
Yeah.
Right. Like, so what really makes people pause isn't cake or death. It's cake or cake, or death or death.
which way to die?
Sir, it's which way do you choose? It's not that you're going to have cake. It's which kind of cake? Like, how many times have we argued over that, right? Like, way more than, like, are we going to have cake or go home? You know, so we tried to deal with that. And there's one other that's kind of interesting. And this is really interesting in modern day situations and things that we're seeing. So one of the things that was really interesting in this game was trying to figure out how to deal with certain moral dilemmas that were not as cut and dry then as they are now. So we'll set aside issues around slavery, although we address that in the game. We'll talk about the Jane, this is where I'm going to get in trouble, right? But there's a young woman who is scalped and murdered ostensibly by Native Americans who are with the British, who are marching towards Saratoga. And this historical incident is taught and everybody's like upset, and like, it sort of points out, it's always used to sort of talk about like how the British had aligned themselves and allowed these Iroquois warriors to kind of run amok. And it, you know, war's not a pretty thing that we're constantly reminded about. But the interesting thing is there's still some discrepancies over exactly what happened. But the other part of it is, in this day and age, people would sort of play a game like this and they would say, well, I know these things were wrong. What they did was wrong. The way we treated Native Americans, the way we treated African Americans, the way that we treated Quakers, other, all kinds of things, you know, was wrong. We have a larger sort of understanding of what those things look like now. So you're a game player, you're making these decisions. And part of the problem is if you can't express to the game your current sensibilities, then it's hard for players. They will, it's this weird problem. The game is now, right? I live now. Yeah. And the game is then. It's depicting times then. So we had to, at times, not every time, think about creative ways to deal with this problem, which is allowing people to express their things. But at the same time, you can't have a game that realistically is like, look, oh, we're going to just do everything right, like morally right, and win the war, right? Like, that might not have happened. So for instance, when you do things in this particular case with this incident, what we did was we said, look, we can't be 100% sure what really happened, but what we can be sure of is that it was a big issue at the time that riled people up. It was a little bit of propaganda at that time. So you can decide, we're not going to say that this event does or doesn't happen. You don't get to make that decision, but you get to make the decision of whether or not you're going to double down on using it to achieve your objective, or you're going to kind of say, like, let's this one slide, like, let's not double down on, oh, look at this, this is so awful what the British did, and it really happened, and this is, you know, and we're going to, you know, so you get to decide that. So it's a way for you to somewhat apply, maybe, if you feel like this was a really awful moment and you want to kind of maybe sidestep it a little, but you pay a price for doing that. And you maybe come away understanding not necessarily whether something was 100% right or wrong in hindsight, but you come away saying, like, why would somebody have shouted this from the rooftops, look at this awful thing that someone did to this woman, and use it to then denigrate the other side to the point a lot more people turn out. In the case of certain regional things, whether it be slavery or other things, you can potentially exercise more liberty towards those things within some level of realism. You know, where, for instance, during the actual war, Pennsylvania votes to abolish votes for an abolition element during the war. There are black regiments that are raised in Rhode Island. There's some proposed even in the South. But you know, what the game says is, like, great, these things will gain liberty. They will add to your liberty score, but they will also potentially detract from your unity score or your Southern support, because you have to deal with the ramifications of these things as they could have happened in history then. So yes, you can have your current day understanding and much higher sense of enlightenment, but you can't skate free just because we know better now.
So we've told you guys a lot about the game. Our guest today has been Ben Sawyer of Digimill, who has created this great game, Revolutionary Choices, which I will say I have learned things about the revolution that I didn't know before by playing it. And I'm a university professor. Where can the people listening go to find out more about this game and possibly play it?
So the game is called Revolutionary Choices. It's going to be out sometime in the early-ish middle of summer, if not sooner. We're at the, like, 99% done part. We're really trying to tweak and improve small bits of text and points of historical accuracy we want to have a little bit tighter than they may have been. The game is being funded and published by the Society of the Cincinnati, which is America's oldest patriotic organization that is made up of members who are descended from Washington's officer corps. And one of their charters is to make sure that people really understand what happened during the Revolutionary War and the sacrifices and decisions that were needed in order to achieve independence for America. And also that the values that went into the war and that were happening during the war also directly did have effect on the kind of country that was formed thereafter. So they will be publishing the game. It'll be available on the web and in app stores. So two different versions, but the same game. And right now, if you want to keep up on, like, the second the game is available, you'll find it at revchoicesgame.org, or you can visit the Society's website at societyofthecincinnati.org. Our game is at revchoicesgame.org, and you'll be able to find it in the App Store and Google Play Store when it's available by typing in Revolutionary Choices, I would assume, into the search engine on those stores, and you'll be able to download it to your Android or iOS device, and you'll be able to play it on a web browser on your desktop computer. So it will be very easy to get. It will be free. It's completely free. This is a gift being made to the public by the Society of the Cincinnati. It is part of their educational charter. And, you know, we're really thankful to an organization that came up. A lot of these projects you know, are sponsored by either government grants or they're done individually by developers. In this particular case, it was this organization who said, we really want to do something different. The juxtaposition of, you know, these people who are, you know, historians and civic organization, and they're like, we're going to try something that groups like us never do. We're going to ask somebody to make a video game. And that's what they did, and they stuck with it. It's really going to be, I think it's going to be really, really interesting when it's finally done.
Well, that is brilliant. That I've got a class next week. Got to go get the schedule together for it now.
Definitely. I got to go help my son with his homework. But it was really great to meet you.
Likewise, man. Thank you for taking the time, man.
I'm glad you liked the game.
Thank you for listening to The Road to Now. The Road to Now is hosted and produced by Bob Crawford and Dr. Benjamin Sawyer. Our episode is edited by Gary Fletcher. Our social media manager is Austin Sawyer. Today's music, like almost always, is by the lovely and talented Paul DeFiglia. We'd like to say a special thanks to our supporters on Patreon, with a special shout out to our Washingtonians, a list that is longer than ever. Tanya Marsh, Mary Hocking, Paul Ayler, Tim and Caitlin Wells, Big White, Jeff LeCain, Peggy Donica, Susan Sharp, and the newest member who just joined us, Joseph Mann. We've also got a new patron at the Lincoln tier. So Nicholas Greenfield, thank you for joining us. We are glad to have you. If you're listening, want to be on that list, or just want to support The Road to Now, you can do that at patreon.com/TheRoadToNow. We'd love to have you. Lots of extra content there. Also, if you like what you're hearing, please take a minute and rate us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get The Road to Now. It only takes a second and does a lot to help us, keeps us on the charts and everything. Also, if you could, tell a friend. If you think there's an episode they might like, we'd love to have them. Please share. For Bob Crawford, this is Ben Sawyer. Take care.
Osiris.